Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Allison Bektesh.
And I'm Barbara Platts. Aspen was once again visited by high-profile politicians this week.
And the town will be rerouting a crowded intersection.
Communities throughout the valley are turning their attention to public art.
And the Bureau of Land Management is turning its attention to the Thompson Divide.
That's coming up on Mountain Edition.
A trio of Republican governors spoke at the McCloskey Speaker Series on Tuesday night in Aspen. Matt Bevin of Kentucky, Pete Ricketts of Nebraska, and Lawrence Hogan Jr. of Maryland discussed the upcoming presidential election, as well as the challenges they face individually as states. Bevin said he will not endorse Donald Trump, but will vote for him because it's the better choice for the United States. He later said the key to fixing issues in the country is listening to what regular citizens are dealing with, and places like a dollar store in Aspen is where you can find them. When informed the resort town doesn't have such a store, Bevin pivoted quickly.
Ask a military veteran, ask a firefighter, ask the person who removes the chocks from the wheel of your plane when you fly out of here. How about that? Ask these people what's happening.
Ricketts spoke about his business experience and how that helped him lead Nebraska, making it what CNN had called one of the best places for business. You can hear the full talk at aspenpublicradio.org.
While many state lawmakers are busy with campaign season, that doesn't mean they've forgotten about some of the future policies they'll be crafting. Benta Berkland reports from the state capitol.
Committees are already meeting to begin looking at possible legislation for the next legislative session, which begins in January. A bipartisan group of lawmakers reviewing issues related to wildfires, mitigation, and forest health will meet on Monday. They've been on tours and will hear from experts such as the Colorado State Forest Service and state fire chiefs. The committee still has two more meetings before a final slate of bills will be revealed. A Water Resources Review Committee is also gathering on Tuesday to discuss a host of issues, ranging from well permits and inspections to how water diversion impacts the value of a water right. Later in the week, another group will examine mental illness in the criminal justice system. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
The first in a series of public open houses regarding the town of Basalt's controversial river park begins tonight.
The Basalt Town Council has yet to approve a bond measure that would appear on the ballot in this November's election. Residents would be asked to allow the town to take on $9 million in debt so it can build out what's being called the Basalt River Park on the Pan and Fork parcel. Recent conceptual drawings of the publicly owned space have drawn criticism, as has the growing price tag. Tonight's open house will include information about the project, including costs and the terms of the bond repayment. Comment cards will be collected and the feedback will be presented to the town council prior to its final decision on whether the proposal should go to the voters. Tonight's meeting is from 6 to 8 p.m. in Basalt Town Hall. Five additional open houses are scheduled for this month. Full details are available at aspenpublicradio.org.
The woman who embezzled nearly $500,000 from a local government faces resentencing next month. As Aspen Public Radio's Carolyn Zachariasen reports, the cash she had stashed away could affect how long she remains in prison.
Last year, Robin McMillan was convicted of stealing over $400,000 from her employer, the Garfield County Clerk's Office. While in prison, she talked openly about having cash in a box at her son's house. The district attorney's office received a tip from an inmate about the secreted cash and was able to recover $56,000 a few weeks ago. It will be given back to Garfield County as part of the restitution McMillan is ordered to pay back. Sherry Kaloya is the district attorney for the 9th Judicial District. She doubts that all of the money will ever be paid back, but the discovered cash will at least go towards part of the county's insurance deductible. When McMillan goes before a judge for resentencing, Kaloya hopes the recent discovery is taken into consideration.
That's going to go a long way to the court to see that she is not rehabilitated and does not take responsibility for her actions.
The Court of Appeals overturned McMillan's sentence because of a technicality. She goes before a judge on September 1st. Carolyn Zachariasen, Aspen Public Radio News.
Colorado Parks and Wildlife is encouraging anglers to catch and keep as many fish as possible at Harvey Gap State Park near Silt. Aspen Public Radio's Elizabeth Stewart Severy has the details.
The Siltwater Conservancy District says it will need to drain Harvey Gap Reservoir to inspect the dam outlet structure, which is over 100 years old. So in an emergency fish salvage, all limits on bagging, possession, and size have been lifted for anglers. The reservoir is a popular spot for anglers, including ice fishing in December and January, which is unlikely this season. It's home to a variety of fish, including trout, yellow perch, pike, bass, and channel catfish. Mike Porras is with Colorado Parks and Wildlife and explains that two of those species, the northern pike and the smallmouth bass, are desirable to fishermen but are aggressive predators who eat some native fish.
They're not compatible with our recovery efforts, and so they're not a species that we would restock, but they are there now, and we certainly encourage anglers to go out and catch as many of those as they can.
The water from Harvey Gap has been slowly draining throughout the summer for irrigation and is not being backfilled. It should be low enough to complete the inspection late this fall, and Kelly Lyon, president of the Siltwater Conservancy, says he hopes the water will be back in the reservoir next spring. Porras says it's likely that some of the tougher fish, like the catfish, may survive the winter in low water. After the inspection and any necessary repairs, Colorado Parks and Wildlife will decide which species will be used to restock the reservoir.
The body of a 29-year-old man identified as Ryan Bickvarick was found in an irrigation ditch near Sopris Park in Carbondale over the weekend. Witnesses called 911 Sunday evening and first responders from Carbondale police pulled the body from the water. Bickvarick was transported to Valley View Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. An autopsy revealed no trauma, and an initial investigation indicates that he drowned, according to Garfield County Coroner Robert Glassmeyer. Officials are asking that anyone with information contact the Garfield County Coroner's office.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
$1 million and 2 years of work later, the Mill Street Complete Streets project needs some refinement. After the city heard complaints from motorists, traffic will be rerouted through the intersection of Main and Mill Streets.
Aspen Public Radio's Carolyn Zachariasen met up with the city's senior project manager, Justin Foreman, and city engineer, Trish Aragon, to talk about the changes.
As you notice, this intersection that we're standing at, Mill and Main, the right turn lane is a through and right lane, so we're going to reconfigure that and working with CDOT, so it's just a right turn lane. The through lane is going to be in the left lane instead of in the right lane. There's more cars turning right in this intersection than left.
These changes were made last year, and we heard it from the community. So we had a third-party traffic study done, and from that traffic study, it showed that to make this intersection operate, you know, at a better level of service, having this right turn only and then the left straight, because there really weren't too many cars that were going straight, and they were the ones bogging up the guys turning right.
And when you said you had heard from the community, what did you hear?
Basically, you know, I'm trying to turn right, and it's taken me longer to get through that process because of the cars going straight.
I don't know if you remember the signal pole and what it looked like before, but it was all bent out of shape because trucks were hitting it, and the turning radius wasn't big enough for trucks. So we needed to protect, so we put a new signal pole in here. And in order to protect that, we needed to bump this out so that trucks could have that turning radius around this corner.
Getting rid of the third lane was also following today's standards with lane widths. We gained 8 feet, and those were for the bicycle lanes, and that's technically too small for a third lane.
What we're also going to do is change the signal, how it identifies bikes at this intersection. So it'll now recognize a bike and allow green time for a bike to go through this intersection. And we're going to have an actual bike box is what it's called for bikes to make it easier to go through this intersection for bikes.
How would it be different?
Right now, as a bicyclist, you get in the lane and act as if you were a car. What this will do is have a designated area for the bicycles out in front to go straight or turn left. We're going through the approval process with CDOT. We hope to have that wrapped up in the next couple weeks, and we would hope to do it in this fall shoulder season.
That was Justin Foreman and Trish Aragon with the City of Aspen talking about the upcoming changes at the intersection of Main and Mill Streets. To hear the full interview, log on to aspenpublicradio.org.
Governor John Hickenlooper's memoir, The Opposite of Woe, My Life in Beer and Politics, is a deep dive into his life with what he calls warts and all. Aspen Public Radio's Patrick Fort spoke with Hickenlooper at a book signing event at Explore Booksellers last week.
One thing I think is interesting about you in your book is there's this one thing I've kind of observed is that you kind of represent what I think of as like the new Colorado. It's kind of, I think there's this perception still that people are slowly starting to lose that Colorado is, you know, primary, it's like ranching and cows and all that stuff. But, you know, we have all this, all the tech sector, obviously brewing is a large industry. And I feel like you're one politician person who kind of embodies that new aesthetic of Colorado. I want to know what you think of that, or if I'm crazy, maybe.
I think that Colorado still has a strong blend of conservative and liberal. And, you know, most people, I'm very liberal socially, but pretty conservative fiscally. So in a funny way, I'm kind of a representation of the old Colorado as well. I have had more interface with the new technology industries. And, you know, I get a lot of credit for the renaissance of lower downtown, probably more than I deserve. And that, you know, that renaissance is kind of the new Colorado, right? Taking an old abandoned warehouse district and making it into a vibrant urban area with light rail and a multimodal transportation hub and Union Station. That is kind of, you know, symbolic of the new Colorado. But I'm also, you know, about, you know, grinding it out and you know, trying to make sure we have enough water and enough water storage. Colorado's been working on that for many decades.
Backtracking a little bit, what was your favorite part about putting this book together? Do you see yourself as a writer?
Well, I always did see myself as a writer, and I, you know, majored in English, took creative writing. But I never, I mean, by the time I was finished college, my friends had made it abundantly clear that I was not a writer. And I was also such an extrovert that it was hard just to sit down and spend 2 or 3 hours thinking and writing. You know, I get energy from being with people, but I also, you know, my energy, the longer I'm outside of a conversation of some sort, you know, that for me kind of takes energy out of me.
That was Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper speaking with Aspen Public Radio's Patrick Fort at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. To hear more of their conversation, go online to aspenpublicradio.org.
Colorado is investing millions of dollars in the arts throughout the state. The money supports film, public art, and the state's Creative District program, which tries to help rural economies grow through the arts.
In the Roaring Fork Valley, municipalities are figuring out ways to incorporate public art and make their towns a great place to support artists. In just the past month, the relationship between the arts and government has evolved. Again, Aspen Public Radio's Patrick Fort.
This is Interstate 70, probably the last place you'd expect to see a piece of art, right? Just a few feet away is the Glenwood Springs Center for the Arts. There's a giant metal bird sitting outside.
This piece was purchased by the city of Glenwood last year, and it is installed here permanently.
That's Christina Brusig, executive director of the center. There are 23 pieces installed in Glenwood Springs. It's part of an effort to bring public art to the community. Why? To give residents and visitors something to think about, she says, something to look at and touch.
It makes the town more attractive overall, and it's a vital part of what communities and community art centers do to bring art into the public. That's part of our mission, is to just spread the love of art.
The hard part, she says, is finding art that everyone can agree on.
There are people who are like, oh my gosh, the murals suck, and we don't like this. This isn't art. This isn't what we want. And so that's where, as an artist, you understand that art is in the eye of the beholder. Everyone will feel different about something that they see. And so that's why we try to provide a wide variety.
But remember the part about the piece being owned by the city? That's just one example of how art groups are getting closer to government. The building that houses the Glenwood Springs Center for the Arts flooded this summer. The group has since been trying to move into a vacant space downtown. Community members lobbied in front of City Council for the arts group to get that space. The relationship between arts and the city of Aspen is a very different one. As far as public art goes, there isn't really a formal way for the city to handle it.
It's so easy to end up with just a hodgepodge of different things.
City Councilwoman Ann Mullins said on Tuesday that a proposal by the Parks Department to create an art board was a good one. The city wants to create a formal arts board to handle where art goes, for how long, and who takes care of it, among other things. Right now, it's kind of handled by committee.
The town of Snowmass Village already has something like that established. A group known as the Snowmass Arts Advisory Board has been discussing with government officials about how to get more public art in the village. Outside of Snowmass Village Town Hall, three giant metal rings are part of a piece called Transparency. Julianne Woods is Community Development Director for Snowmass Village.
I see it as looking out into the future of our community. So for me, it's definitely a reminder of what our role is.
She says as a government employee, she views the piece as a window out into the community and a window into government. Part of Wood's job is to help the Snowmass Art Advisory Board get events planned, among other things. She works with Carol Batchelder, one of the founding members of what's called the SOB. Part of what makes public art what it is in Snowmass, Batchelder says, is the level of interactivity people can have with it.
Employees of the town, or staff of the town, can go outside for lunch and sit on the marble pieces that are installed around it.
Snowmass Village has linked its public art with what's called the Art Walk. Trails join each piece. Carbondale has a similar idea along the Rio Grande Trail. The town of Basalt also has recently put out requests to find public art pieces and is supporting a proposed performing arts center. Patrick Fort, Aspen Public Radio News.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Barbara Platts. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Also online, you can sign up for Aspen Public Radio's new ForkFed digital newsletter. ForkFed comes out every Friday, updating you on the week's news in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond.
As the city of Aspen works to maintain a healthy forest, developers face hefty fees to remove trees. Sometimes, though, city council is willing to let those trees fall in order to save a building. Aspen Public Radio's Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports.
When you take down an 85-foot-tall spruce tree in a residential neighborhood, you start with the top. That's the sound of about 25 feet of spruce falling neatly into a cleared construction zone. Dan Strange is the owner of Quality Tree Service, and he's overseeing the removal of 8 large spruces from a lot in the West End. He explains the process.
Sort of like the concept how you eat an elephant, you know, one bite at a time.
The city takes a bite, too. Property owners who remove trees to build face some steep fees. The cost to mitigate reaches quickly into the thousands of dollars, up to over $50,000 based on the trunk diameter. The first step, though, is a permit from city forester Ben Carlson.
Not all of the trees that are requested for these development permits for removal, a lot of times they're not permitted for removal because that development can occur without that happening.
In those cases, most developers have to build around existing trees. But sometimes city council gets involved, like it did with those 8 big spruces. Those sat on the historic Burko property, which is being updated. It involves moving the original building to the other side of the lot, and the trees were in the way of making that happen. The noted photographer's post-war Bauhaus-style studio is protected under the Aspen Modern Historic designation. So approval to take out one of those evergreens came straight from city council after Carlson denied the request. Even when Carlson is disappointed to see trees cut down, he says the city's forest is healthy, even overplanted in areas. That might be because property owners who remove trees to build have a choice. Pay thousands in fees to the city, or invest that money into planting new trees. Carlson says many people choose the latter.
There are a lot more trees planted than are being removed, because we all know and understand the benefits of trees.
How many trees are removed each year as a result of development? We're not sure, but Carlson says he's just starting to take inventory. Perhaps no one knows trees better than the guys who do the work to trim and cut them, like Quality Tree Services' Chad Strange, who has worked for his dad's business since he was a kid. It's hard work cutting down 85-foot-tall trees, both physically and emotionally.
It shatters my heart. I weep for the trees because that's a living organism, you know, that produces oxygen for us. you know, it hurts me, but I'll go home and I'll plant trees.
Elizabeth Stewart-Severy from the Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
For years, the nonprofit EcoFlight has been flying politicians, journalists, and concerned citizens over a pristine corridor outside of Carbondale that's being eyed by oil and gas companies for drilling. The Bureau of Land Management has released a plan for the area that has both industry and environmental groups wanting more. Aspen Public Radio's Elizabeth Stewart-Severy recently flew over the Thompson Divide and has this report.
It's difficult to see much of the White River National Forest from roads, and that's intentional. There are few of them cutting through a narrow corridor of land near the Thompson Divide from Carbondale to Battlement Mesa. Groups like Wilderness Workshop, Trout Unlimited, and EcoFlight want to keep it this way, but oil companies say this area has great potential for energy development. From above, you can see a stretch of pristine forest, including the northern end of an enormous aspen grove that stretches all the way from Kebler Pass. The perimeter, especially toward Battlement Mesa, is dotted with existing oil and gas well pads. Environmental and sportsmen's groups want this landscape preserved.
There's a large black bear population, the moose population that's increased significantly over the past few years. It's a very popular hunting area in Colorado, brings in quite a bit of money for the area. So from a sportsman's perspective, this area is extremely important to keep protected, pristine, connected.
Kara Armano is on the plane with Trout Unlimited, a group that represents anglers and hunters. She's among those who applaud the BLM for canceling 25 leases in the Thompson Divide and advocate for stronger stipulations elsewhere in the area. A top priority for Armano and other sportsmen is protecting the population of Colorado cutthroat trout, a native species that thrives in the high alpine rivers and streams of this area. Armano is also quick to point out that this part of White River National Forest is prime hunting territory. 30,000 big game licenses are issued every year. This current plan within the BLM's environmental impact statement is somewhat unique in that it considers existing oil and gas leases, 65 of them to be exact, that were issued in the 1990s and early 2000s. This type of retroactive consideration of environmental impacts can be contentious. David Boyd is with the BLM. He says the plan is a compromise between environmental and industry interests, but acknowledges that this is likely to be a long process.
We really think it's a good compromise, but it's very typical in our decisions that we reach a compromise and a balance, and it's very typical that the various sides aren't completely happy with the decisions we make.
Industry representatives say that's an understatement. David Ludlum of the West Slope Colorado Oil and Gas Association calls the decision a capricious and disturbing breach of contract.
That's the heart of the matter for us, is it's completely arbitrary, it's completely subjective, and it makes no sense at all outside the lens of just sheer politics.
Ludlum says the retroactive stipulations and cancellation of leases ignores the potential for producing an important resource. Companies that own leases but have not yet developed wells could lose a lot of profit, according to Ludlum, despite compensation from the BLM. His and other industry organizations say they will continue to push the BLM to allow development, especially following a U.S. Geological Survey report that ranked the Manco Shale Formation as having high potential. Environmentalists say their work isn't done either, though the BLM is on the right track, says Will Rausch of Wilderness Workshop.
You know, BLM's really good decision to cancel 25 leases in the Thompson Divide could be really well complemented by protecting those additional 27 leases. The boundary between those is apparent when you look at a lease map, but it's not apparent to an elk, it's not apparent to a stream, it's not apparent to the air that moves between the two. And so it's, you know, our perspective is it's really not enough to just protect the Thompson Divide. We want to make sure that protection is landscape-wide and really grounded in ecology.
A final record of decision by the BLM is expected in the late fall, and administrative or legal battles are likely to follow.
The race for state elected positions are just heating up. Over the weekend, candidates made public appearances before attending private fundraisers Saturday night. Allison stopped by the Aspen Farmers Market to hear constituents' concerns.
Amidst fresh produce, live classical music, and friends greeting one another, Colorado Senate candidate Daryl Glenn stands in the shade of the Pickens County Republicans' tent, shaking hands with admirers.
Thank you so much. That means a lot.
Glenn won a five-way primary race to be the Republican nominee selected to challenge incumbent Democratic Senator Michael Bennett. 2 weeks later, he was on stage at the Republican National Convention, giving a primetime speech attacking Hillary Clinton and standing up for the All Lives Matter movement. Glenn says his general election campaign strategy is to continue to involve all voters in his platform.
You know, at the very beginning, you know, we wanted to have a grassroots campaign. And my focus has been and will continue to be to go out and actually talk to people and find out what are the issues that they're facing.
Are you hearing anything specific to Aspen or the Roaring Fork kind of interests?
They are very concerned about, you know, jobs, you know, and really, universally, the two main themes, you know, the defense of this country, some of the challenges that we're having, and how do we jumpstart this economy? Those are the two big things that we really need to come together on. And so we're going to have some clear lines of distinction between what the other side wants to present as their plan, but I have a very positive outlook on what we should do.
John Beeman and his wife recognized Glenn as they did their market shopping. Beeman says he has been following Glenn from the start.
He's a veteran for one. He's got our rights as veterans and definitely the support to bring this country back where it needs to be. And, we need to keep this state back on the Republican side. I'm really afraid that it's turning the other direction.
Are you going to be out there voting?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We've got to vote. We've got to vote. 100%. If people think this country's not in trouble, they're naive.
One block away, the Pickens County Democrats were introducing State Representative Millie Hamner to market goers and registering new voters. 21-year-old Jack Paley works at a booth at the market and took advantage of the opportunity to become a first-time registered voter.
Yeah, just perusing, and you know what? It's a good thing to do to register to vote. If not, what's the point?
Have you been paying attention?
Yeah, you know, follow along as much as any kid my age does. Tried to make an educated decision, but definitely still time between now and election date to learn more about which is the best vote for myself.
Once the election's all said and done, what do you think the first priority of our lawmakers should be?
Well, I don't know about the first, but I think that environmental protection is important. I think that education is important. I think that having a clean and healthy environment for people to grow up and live in is important. I don't know about the first, but those are all important things to work on.
An Aspen Music School student who is registered out of state describes himself as a political junkie and met with both visiting candidates this weekend. The student, who is uncomfortable giving his name, says his biggest worry is the divisive rhetoric that the election season has featured.
Honestly, I think I'm really worried because I think our discourse has gone to such a level where it's not intelligent debate anymore, and it's just nasty, and I think, honestly, Trump in particular, it's been terrible.
The Democrats raised over $1,000 at a private event this weekend. Fundraising numbers for the Republicans' Lincoln Day dinner that also featured incumbent Congressman Scott Tipton and former presidential candidate Carly Fiorina are not yet available.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Barbara Platts.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. To hear the show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. A panel of journalists join news director Carolyn Zachariasen to provide analysis, insight, and context to the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.